You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast, the Blair Witch franchise.
Welcome to the Surgeons of Horror podcast. Its purpose is to look into the horror films, dissecting them one screen legend and franchise at a time. Our podcast subject for this episode is the modern classic, The Blair Witch Project, and the franchise that followed. In order to successfully do this, we need a team of horror aficionados who will form the surgical team each episode. So, let me introduce you. First up is yours truly, Paul Farrell, lead surgeon and host for this series of the podcast. Joining me each episode at the operating theatre is a select team of horror gurus who are hand-selected to perform the surgical task of dissecting each movie. First up is Chief Surgical Technician Ben Skinner.
Hello.
Hello indeed. It's very gentlemanly of your introduction.
That's what happens when I do podcasts with you guys. That's I take on this.
That's how the British roll.
You were like some European guy a few podcasts back. Now you're bringing a bit of Englishness to it. And your job here is to literally get into the guts of the subject each podcast. Mm-hmm. Alongside us who was New Blood, but now he's a fully fledged member of the team, Bedroom. Nick Allford.
Cherry popped. Hi,
Cherry
guys.
Popped. Hi, welcome aboard. And you're on hand with some surgical tools and know-how to offer throughout the procedure. So that's the team. So without further ado, let's dissect our movie in question, the Blair Witch franchise, and in particular start off with the Blair Witch Project, which was brought to our screens back in 1999 and has something of a resurgence of late due to the recent cinema release of Blair Witch, which has been dubbed an official sequel as well. Before we begin, let's just have a quick round table. When did you first see the Blair Witch Project and what was your first reactions? Let's go with Nick.
When I was 19 at uni, when it first was released, and there was still that whole the story behind whether or not it's real, whether or not it's fake, and we didn't quite have the internet the same way we do now. You couldn't just Google it and find out exactly what's going on straight away.
No, that's correct.
And so especially when there's so much mythology behind it as well.
Yeah. So was it 99 or 2000?
99.
99. That was a big year for movies, wasn't it? Like, that was a fan, I'm a fan of Menace year, but like The Matrix as well. Like, I feel
Fight Club was year before, maybe, I think, or something. Around that time, anyway.
Fight Club was 99 as well, I think.
Yeah, it was a big year for movies. They game changing movies as well. Like, it's funny that coming out of going into the millennium was just like, you know, all this stuff people think of as 90s films, but really they're more like noise.
Yeah, you're right. Like, it was on that kind of precipice as you were of that.
And there'd be a lot of imitators that would follow, especially The Matrix.
Good point. So what were your memories of, or when did you first see the film?
It was late in the game, I think. I made sure I watched it at daytime during the day.
Oh, you're such a pop out.
It was on VHS. Woohoo! I don't think DVD quite come along yet, but yeah, it definitely like creeped me out. Still, I was by myself. There was no one else. Like, I had there was the family home, and it was just me watching it. But I think it had been slightly ruined by the fact all my friends had seen it already and had kind of talked about it a little bit. But it's still effective. I think that whole, I mean, I'm sure we'll discuss the whole everyone thinking it's kind of real. Like, I don't think for a second I was under that impression.
Is that because you watched it later in the game, though, do you think? By that definitely. Point, you're already aware of, of the mock.
But I think looking back now, I really wish I had. I think I was just too young to, because was this MA or M?
Would have been.
I feel like it would have been too.
I'm trying to cast my mind back.
My parents wouldn't have let me. They were quite strict 18. With what I watched.
Oh, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have been able to see that at the cinema, so that's why I had to wait all that time.
How old were you back in 99? I don't mean to bring up the whole baby thing.
I would have
thing.
Been like 12 or 13 at the time. So, just under that, although you can go to an MA film, but I think you've got to be accompanied by...
You've got to be accompanied by somebody older than...
So no one was willing to take me.
No one wanted to take you. Your uncle said, no, you can't watch that. Here's Jaws 2.
That's right.
So from my point of view, I was one of the people that went to see it when it was in the film, in the cinema release, and I'll hold my hand up and went on record in previous podcasts as well saying I hated it. And I knew that I was in the minority with that. And basically, I reckon I was about 19 or so too at the time. But I came out just thinking it was just a bunch of whiny Americans walking through a forest, and I just couldn't get over that.
Yeah.
And I know that was my thing.
I was a little bit like that too, actually.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, get over it. But like since then, when I've rewatched it, and it's not because I've kind of jumped on the bandwagon, I can assure you. But since then, when I've rewatched it, I've actually kind of found new respect for it. And a lot of that's because, as Ben might be aware, but I'm not so sure about Nick, but I kind of write and produce and direct stuff as well, and I'm a big fan of background story, and there's so much that goes into this movie, and the more I read about it and the more kind of I learnt about how much detail went into it, my whole kind of perspective changed on the movie itself. So that kind of wraps up, you know, I guess our initial reactions when we first watched the movie.
I almost thought there's too much backstory in some.
Seriously?
Yeah, rewatching it again, I was trying to work out exactly what the Blair Witch story was. And when they interview the local townsfolk,
yeah,
you know, it's sort of like, this guy went off and he stole 7 kids and he came back saying, I'm done. And then these other 2 guys went missing. And then it sort of then goes back before that to someone being, you know, a witch and...
Yeah, that's right.
It gets a bit confusing, to be honest.
No. And this is a great segue because I've actually written down in chronological order of what actually happens. So what builds up legend of the Blair Witch. And so bear with me because there's a few dates that they're kind of thrown in there. I kind of got this from the... there was a book that was called The Blair Witch Project, a dossier. So it was kind of like an account written like a written account of the film that we've seen. So there's lots of interviews and stuff. There was another documentary that was released called The Curse of the Blair Witch, which again goes a bit deeper and talks to a lot of people as well. Go on.
I watched that.
Yeah.
I watched about 10 minutes of it. And I was like, this is pointless. It's like 10 minutes of people going, wow, I love this guy. And she was such a great student and he did that.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I know it's not real. So maybe if I'd have watched it before the movie, been, oh, cool, that would have been a great doco.
I think that's the thing. I don't know when, I presume it got released after the fact, but it's... for me, it serves as a good prequel to what you see in the film because you get like kind of this hype build up to what I found about the book as well, because I read through it just recently as well. I found that was a great account. You know, it's basically what you see in the curse essentially, and a few other bits and pieces tied up with it too. And it follows the investigator who gets hired by the family to try and work out what had gone on, and he gets access to the tapes and stuff.
Right.
And it's done in a quite a good way. So I thought it kind of serves as a great companion piece, you know, to the film. But anyway, as I said, let's look at the legend that built the Blair Witch. So I do think it's imperative that we talk about the background. And there are spoilers in case you've not seen the movie, as well. I should add, because as we've already said, it's a complete fabrication. For me, though, as I already said, it's the extensive detail that's gone into the legend that makes this movie so strong. And without it, it would fall flat on its face and not have a leg to stand on. So here's a breakdown of the events that led up to what we officially see on screen. In February 1788, several children accuse a woman called Ellie Kedwood of luring them into their home to draw blood from them. Kedwood is found guilty of witchcraft, banished from the village during a particular harsh winter and presumed dead. We then fast forward to November 1786. Sorry, that should have been February 1785. We fast forward to November 1786. By midwinter, all of Kedwood's accusers, along with half the town's children, vanish. Fearing a curse, the townspeople flee Blair and vow never to utter Kelly Kedwood's name again. So that's like the first kind of a thing that happens. There's about 4 events that kind of lead up to what we see on screen. In 1809, there is a book that's released called The Blair Witch Cult. Apparently it's a rare book, commonly considered fiction, and it tells of an entire town cursed by an outcast witch. We then go to 1824, and that's when Burkittsville is founded on the site where Blair, the town, existed. In August 1825, 11 witnesses testify to seeing a pale woman's hand reach up and pull a 10-year-old, Eileen Treacle, into Tappy East Creek. Her body is never recovered. For 13 days after the drowning, the creek is bogged with oily bundles of sticks. So that's the second incident. Then in March 1886, an 8-year-old named Robin Weaver is declared missing, and search parties are dispatched. Although Weaver returns, one of the search parties does not. Their bodies are found weeks later at Coffin Rock, tied together at the arms and legs and completely disemboweled. Then we come to November 1940 to May 1941, starting with Emily Holland's disappearance. A total of seven children are abducted from the area of Burkittsville, Maryland. In May 1941, an old hermit named Rustin Parr walks into a local market and tells the people there that he is finally finished. After police hike for 4 hours to a secluded house in the woods, they find the bodies of seven missing children in the cellar. Each child has been ritualistically murdered and disemboweled. Parr admits to the killings, telling us a voice in his head, an old woman, commanded his actions. He's quickly convicted and hanged. That sums up what essentially the legend is. So there's basically about every 50 years or so, something kind of happens around this area, and it's all kind of hinted at that this is a curse that's on the area that the Blair Witch is haunting. So, I mean, that's a lot of history to surmise, but I feel, as I said, it was integral to the makeup. And in addition, you know, to the mockumentary that we were talking about, The Curse of the Blair Witch, and the book as well. We've also got to mention that Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez, the filmmakers, had a website set up in its early days too. And it's continually, to this day, being updated with little notes and things that support the legend. What are your thoughts on the amount of the background? I mean, you were saying it was too much, Nick. What do you feel, Ben?
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Like, I think it loses a bit of the... I mean, obviously it didn't really hurt them, like, at the box office or anything like that. But that
ahead of its time, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, it's emulated.
But looking at it now, I agree with you. Like, that actually takes away some of the effectiveness had it just been, like, pared down, I guess.
So where I come from, and this is where I guess I disagree with you two, is that... The technique that they decided to go with is that they basically hired three actors that they needed to have great improvisational skills. They had a background, a backstory there, like of this stuff here. And without that, if you're relying on the fact that a lot of the dialogue is improv, everything would have just fallen over. It's really, really important that if you're having a series of improvised conversations around what's occurring, then you need to have some kind of meat to the bones, you know, so it's like it's not going to work. So that's why I felt particularly if you're going to go with that kind of approach, it needed that that kind of amount of background there. And maybe it's one or two, because I admittedly got confused between the two of the girls that disappeared, the Emily Holland one and the one before her. I got them confused in the storyline. I didn't realise there were two separate girls that kind of went missing.
But the way the actors deliver the backstory in the movie,
it might not
make a massive amount of sense, but I think that's also what a documentary sometimes does.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually a bit more raw. If each one individually told you a story, and then she did this, and then everyone said, and then she did that, you'd be like, oh, well, that's all put together.
Yeah, it's true.
Whereas when you have a mum telling a scary story and the little kid's putting her mouth on her mum's face to stop her talking.
Yeah.
You know, it all feels so natural and organic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's already what they've set up. We get this... let's kind of go to the movie itself. I've broken it down into days as far as we see it told on screen. So, like, day one is where we meet the three filmmakers. So we're told it's 1994... we meet Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Michael Williams. These are three filmmakers who are hiking out into the Black Hills to make a documentary on the Blair Witch legend. This is where we get most of the background information that I've detailed just before, in the form of conversations between the filmmakers and the local residents, particularly around Rustin Parr and Ellie Kedwood at this point. Ellie Kedwood being the Blair Witch. The students also interview Mary Brown, who's a local resident deemed insane by the public. She claims to have seen the Blair Witch and describes her as a hairy, half-human, half-animal beast. What are your thoughts on our characters at this point in our introductions and the setup that they're trying to go with here, Nick?
Oh, God, mate, I'm so glad we didn't see the Blair Witch, if that's what she looks like, because it sounds bloody ridiculous. I mean, I know the directors are fans of Bigfoot, and it kind of sounds like a female Bigfoot, so if you'd seen that coming out, you'd be like, oh, no.
I think that was them trying to have a bit of fun with what the crazy onlooker always says.
Yeah.
It's just, it could be complete opposite. It was a minotaur.
Five arms.
Yeah.
So they are kind of working, there are the people they interview and the locals are kind of, they are tick boxing like your stereotypes that you kind of see. There's the one that's kind of been a bit half jokey, you know, but deep down there's a serious underline of, no, this is actually real. There's a couple of people that say, yeah, I've heard of the Blair Witch. Then we get the town crazy as well thrown into the mix. What else do you think of the three main characters at this point? You know, we're only kind of seeing them, you know, the early infancy yet. Heather Donahue's the main character whose thesis it is that they're carrying out to go out and explore the Blair Witch Project, and she's got these two kind of camera and sound guy essentially that come out with it. Are they believable at this point? Or, I mean, like, bearing in mind when I first watched it, I couldn't stand them at all.
Yeah, I get that.
So,
me too, but I didn't think that till later on in the film.
Yeah.
When
they start getting lost. Yeah, I think it's probably when the improv stuff starts happening that they kind of start losing a bit of believability in their performances.
I almost feel the opposite, I think.
Okay.
Because I think when you first see them, something worth noting is that she always changes her character whenever she's in front of camera as well, like she's actually delivering
the
documentary.
Yeah.
And when she's off camera, she's all very naive and perky and, and she has that. It's quite hard to work out the relationship. And having watched the backstory, Curse the Blair Witch, that they've been, what's her name? Heather and not Mike. Who's the other one?
Josh. Joshua here. Yeah,
I just had to remember her shouting. I'm like, Josh, that's right. So they had that sort of relationship beforehand, and they go and pick up Mike. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't really find it, I don't know, as believable. I think maybe it's the performances or anything, but when they're actually out there in the woods,
yeah.
I found it a bit more, because I think for me, the one thing that, without going on a tangent too much, one thing that I loved about this movie before I went to see it was reading up on it, even just in like film review magazines, they were actually put in the woods and they were actually scared. So whether or not you believe the mythology, the one thing I loved is, you know, how much of that is really real.
Yeah.
Maybe the story's not real, but what they're doing is real.
I think it was weird. I'd heard things from friends, but no one had ever like confirmed with me exactly how it was made. I don't think I was reading like any film magazines at the time, and the internet was like dial up, and I had to had to choose my sessions wisely back in those days. I probably just went on to MSN Messenger. But the But yeah, I still don't know whether I was. I think I knew it wasn't real, but I thought maybe it was half real or something, or maybe this was true events being portrayed by actors. But there is some truth to some of the stuff going on. But yeah, like I think it is. I think I'm with Paul. Like I think initially I was kind of just I didn't hate them or love them. But it was later on when I started forming, like, and with some characters more than others.
Yeah.
But initially, they just appear like normal, regular
documentarians
or whatever. But that's pretty. That you saw her changing to ask the questions. I mean, that says that at least she was thinking about a performance in that way.
Like, yeah.
That's a good way of selling it as real. If you can see a change in her character.
Oh yeah, even if it's just in front of camera. When you think about it, they're actually. I think that there was only one shot they didn't shoot themselves. Like, the rest of it, all we see is through the other's eyes.
That's right.
The camera.
Yeah, yeah.
And to support your point, Paul, I think she got a Razzie for her performance in this one.
Did she?
Yeah. So,
that seems
which
harsh.
I think that's unfair. When you watch it back...
It's quite harsh, isn't it?
Yeah. Watching it
back recently. That's the thing, though. I guess that's what I meant by it, you know, in the initial kind of introduction. It's like, I had that knee-jerk reaction to it. But when I've re-watched it, I don't find it as jarring at all. I actually kind of find it more believable. I still find that there are aspects of it that kind of throw you out, and you know, and you're not kind of caught up with it because their performances are questionable. But having said that, I believed it a lot more when I went on repeat viewing. So I don't know what that says about it, really. But
I think maybe because of the way that because it is shot the way that it's shot. Like, it's kind of like Paranormal Activity. Like, I thought the husband was, or boyfriend was just a jerk the first time I saw that.
Yeah.
But when I went back to it again, I was concentrating on other things.
Maybe I need to rewatch that.
Maybe a lot of us would be jerks if we were like, just if you found handycam footage and we're, you know, behind camera just talking, we sound obnoxious or we sound. You know,
true.
It's the extra scrutiny that you get from.
But that's more believable, I guess. If you're doing improv, I heard someone say that when they do improv, it's often a trap that people fall into trying to make themselves brilliant.
Yeah.
But if you actually do improv and you make yourself a bit of a douchebag,
yeah,
that's credit to you for being able to, you know, take yourself down. True. A bit.
So I guess the question is whether it's important that you like them or not. Like, is it actually important? Or is it?
I think you've got to like them to a certain degree because that's your hook. They're the people you're watching for an hour and a half. So you need to have some kind of connection with the people you're supposed to be relating to in order for the story to resonate. So,
but you may also be like maybe one of those cases where you just want them to die and you just. Yeah, but I mean, it's not doing its job.
Yeah.
But you can enjoy a horror movie on that level as well if you just want the characters to.
That's very true.
I'm a firm believer in always having a character to hold on to at some level.
One at least.
But then also, I think there's something about the situation, even if you don't like the characters that much, you can still put yourself in that situation. Yeah. Like, what if you were stuck in the woods? You know, what would you do? Would you start running the camera?
There always
is
that peripheral character, isn't there? There's the one that's kind of the audience.
Yep.
And obviously, it's the main character here. It's usually the heroine in the
Yeah. See, so just to bring up the book again, the dossier book that kind of accompanies the film, there is a bit in there that's a section based on Heather's journal. And you get a kind of real insight into her character a bit more in that, and to the point where she's talking about being intimidated by the fact of being the lone female of the three and felt a bit ganged up on at times.
Yeah.
And that kind of starts when you read that and then rewatch the performance again. You kind of already see that there's that kind of tension already there very early on between the sexes. And I, you know, that's what I was meaning. Like the more I read about it, the more I actually kind of started to really appreciate.
There's a lot more going on here.
Yeah,
and maybe it's almost like what Kubrick would do. Like,
yeah, that's right. Okay, so then we go to day two. So this is, again, a bit more background stuff that's been generated here from, you know, the legend. The filmmakers actually start their hike at this point into the woods. They abandon their car. They meet the two fishermen, a man and his father-in-law, the elder of the two seeming a bit more bitter and grumpy. He's the one that warns them not to go in the woods, and he's also the one that recounts the story of the girl that kind of got pulled into the water as well. Do you want to mention add anything at that point, or for me to?
He sort of the older guy kind of took me out of it a little bit,
yeah,
because his performance isn't that great.
No,
when you come from the old guy, so who even now you almost look at him going, oh, is there really actually like an old mythology, and he's maybe reciting it? Like, I don't think that which is real, but maybe the mythology is when you see the black and white footage at the start.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's black. Yeah, some of it is. That's still very believable.
Yes,
and you know. I think the guy fishing was just like a redneck caricature.
Yeah. It's very true. He was.
Rednecks exist. They are out there.
They do.
It's more forced than
That's it. He felt like he had forced, to hit some marks.
Forced is the right word. Yeah.
So then the filmmakers then hike to Coffin Rock. So this is where the troop that had way back whatever date it was. Went out to find one of the missing girls, and they were found at Coffin Rock, tied together by the hands and legs and disemboweled. So this is where our filmmakers now go to kind of, you know, go and check out the site. And this is also kind of near where the group camped for the night. So it's their first night in the woods. And the second day, also, as I said, the whole of that second day basically serves up as a bit more background kind of stuff that's happening. Within the Blair Witch and the legend and the myth that surrounds it. When we get to day three, the group are somewhat uncertain of their location, and we get the first real indication of a rift forming between them. They eventually find an old cemetery where Josh accidentally disturbs a pile of rocks, or a cairn as it's known, and Heather does her best to kind of, you know, fix it up and repair it. When they camp later that night, they are disturbed by the snapping of sticks from outside, but they easily dismiss it and put it down to just animals outside. So what are we thinking of, like, within this section? It's kind of that stepping stone, you know, you're starting to kind of...
Yeah.
They've obviously disturbed the sacred ground, or not so obviously, that's what they're alluding to. And when we start to kind of have those first kind of seeds sown of maybe there's a presence outside the tent.
And maybe it's, you know, people playing a prank on them, like they thought, or rednecks, or whoever
that's
it
right.
wants to be. And I think that's still, it's still quite ambiguous there.
Yes, it is.
Whereas if you got a shot of, you know, a creepy witch hand dropping off stuff, you're like, right, okay, that's the deal there. And I think that's Are we going to dip into Book of Shadows, or shall we just
start? You could start talking about Book of Shadows here. Yeah, for sure. So just explain, I can explain, Book of Shadows is a sequel, or unofficial sequel, that followed this 1 year after the fact, so in 2000, and it didn't stick to the same look or feel at all. It wasn't a documentary. It was very much an out-and-out kind of narrative, linear narrative.
Yeah, it was very much all over the shop in that respect. Yeah. It was very, you know...
Was it a bit meta? Was it trying to be...
Oh, 100%. Yeah. It was like a doco of the town people, you know, and then one of the town people went mental, and now he runs tours to tour the Blair Witch and then film docos, and you're kind of, by that point, you're like, what?
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of down the track, but yeah, to your point, Nick.
My reason for mentioning it was they were kind of, as it was a sequel, literally made a year after the first, rushed into production. Is the story goes, the studio executives were saying you have to add more horror tropes.
Yeah, right.
You have to. There's a little girl in there for no reason, just and she's sort of slowly walking backwards, and you know, talking backwards and flashing and stuff like that. And it really takes you out of any sort of.
It must have been hard for them to kind of, like, obviously they had freedom on this one, so they weren't fighting that as much. Yeah. But you know that's the thing that exactly.
No, they expected this to be broadcast on a TV network.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
No ambitions that this was going to be released as a nationwide film.
It's funny because if you had all the money in the world, you'd still make the same choice of, you know, subtlety, and that's much creepier than seeing something. You know, just having the sound of.
But there's always that trap, isn't it, where people kind of want to up the ante and outdo the original, which.
Apparently, it's also to keep the younger, like the 13-year-olds who probably paid and sneak in or however they get in there, to keep their attention with suddenly a jump scare.
I mean, the ones that are like making out with their girlfriends anyway. Like,
that's it, yeah.
Not paying attention.
Exactly that. That's one thing the Book of Shadows tried to do, is keep on throwing in, you know, showing you the ghost, showing you the monster.
Yeah.
Which is what I think the original Blair Witch did so well, is you didn't see, you don't see anything the entire movie.
No, that's right.
Which
that's
is incredible. Right. And especially at that crucial point where it's still quite ambiguous.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, it could be anyone.
Yeah, that's great. So we cut to now day four, the group awakens. They discover three of these now like piles of rocks outside their tent. Heather also discovers that their map is missing, which Michael admits to tossing into the creek out of frustration. Josh and Heather then attack him for his actions, and the rift between them widens. Fearing that they may be lost, they decide to head south, where they come across a series of stick figures suspended in the trees. That night, whilst camping, they hear more noises coming from the woods. This time, the sound of children laughing can be heard.
The children laughing.
That's always a good one.
Every time.
And, it works every time. And the tent begins to shake. So there's a bit more of a kind of a physical impact on their makeshift protector. In this case, the tent, and they start to panic, run out into the woods where they hide until morning. So, kind of, what are your thoughts around that kind of section? So, it's two things there. Three things: the rift really starting to form between the group, the stick figures that they come across, and also the very end bit where more physical kind of stuff starts happening to them, and the sound of the kids laughing and stuff. I mean, they're going up another level again each time.
It's playing on elemental fears like that everyone has of being stuck out in the woods, I guess. But the thing I'm surprised at that they don't really, because if I'm trying to picture myself in that situation, I'd probably make light of everything. I'd probably turn it all into a joke, like being the skeptic that I am.
Yes.
But they don't necessarily. They're sort of like more. I guess her more than anyone, but they go straight to being like scared.
That's where I'd go, to be honest, mate. But if I'm in a tent, someone's banging me outside and hear creepy kids, I'd be like, yep, that'll do me.
But I would always try and rationalise it in my head. I'm just like...
So if the tent starts physically shaking, what are you seriously going to be like?
People are like, it's knock, knock.
It's the wind. But I mean, it could be redneck man playing a trick on... trick on them, or...
That'd still do it for me.
But then wouldn't you try and... wouldn't you, if by your rationale, wouldn't you then get out of the tent and say, stop fucking around?
Yeah, I probably would. But it's just like, maybe I wouldn't. Like, who's to say? But I think I probably would make a joke about it to try and defuse the
situation.
Yeah. Okay. But that's. But I guess it doesn't make for very riveting viewing. If one character's just hanging out. Like, it's like the Jamie Kennedy character in Scream. Like, he's just always being a smart ass.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that kind of works.
Yeah, I could see you dying if we were in a horror movie together.
Probably. Yeah.
Didn't know why
that's more the fact.
It's all clear, guys.
That's more the fact that I have no fucking like survival skills though.
Right.
I'd probably just freeze on the first night. Like.
So now we get to day five of the guys being out in the woods, and when they return to their tent, so they've had this scary kind of incident from the night before. They get back to the tent and there's evidence that it's been ransacked and Josh's equipment has been kind of covered in this kind of slime substance. As the group continues to journey southward, they are beginning to show signs of fatigue, even more so when they come across a fallen log which they had crossed previously and they kind of somehow have found out they've walked a full circle. So from that point of view, you know, like they're really kind of like mental fatigue, physical fatigue and despair because they're supposed to be going in one direction and yet they somehow have walked in a full circle. They make camp for the night. Josh then kind of has this mental breakdown, which you don't actually physically see him. It's kind of he's behind the camera as he's doing it. And he starts to verbally attack Heather for leading them there. That's kind of the end of day five.
Yeah, it's quite brutal, that.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when there's so much going on to then just berate someone just right to camera and
yeah,
you know, and I think it's just giving her a taste of her own medicine, I guess, because she's had the camera on them the whole time.
Yeah, that's right. It's like this. It really is turning the tables on that. And I wonder if that was when you re-look back at that, you kind of that's a very good piece of directing that they've done there to really kind of. I presume they shot this in linear order as well. So like,
as far as I know,
they would have then kind of got Joshua to kind of read probably from a script behind the camera and really kind of lay into her, and we're seeing her natural response.
And I still can't picture any of that stuff. But that's the thing.
Yeah, yeah,
no matter how much I try, and all
yeah, the crew,
like, yeah. Like apparently they were left in the forest with a milk crate. Like at
that's
certain
right.
points in the GPS, they'd find a milk crate with like a banana, and a Gatorade or a muesli bar or something like that. And then they have a list of plot points or something they'd have to hit,
and a vague idea of what direction they have to head into.
Yeah, on the GPS to get the next crate, and then say something else happens. And again, this could just be added to the mythology. But I'm assuming it's true.
I know, exactly. I'm taking for it that it's true.
Yeah.
It's almost like they don't want the real full story to come out. Like they want to maintain a bit of... They want
to... Which
the,
you kind of...
Screen,
I think you need
the
to.
Screen up. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that's why it holds up still to this day, because there is so much mythology
that
surrounds
it. Like there's ever
both
been,
on and off the camera.
Yeah, like a comprehensive documentary that pulls apart the entire like film. It would be a mistake, I think.
It's essentially a snuff film, then. You sort of believe it for what it is, which is sort of definitely first of its kind, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely. So then we get to, like, we're into day six now on the screen, and Heather and Michael wake up, and this is where they find that Josh has gone missing. They try to in vain to find him, and then night falls. They can hear Josh's agonized screams in the darkness, but they still can't find him. That's day six. It's a very kind of short section.
But I freaking love it.
Important because of the disappearance of one of them. Yeah.
It just, again, like you say, it's taken an upper level each time.
Yeah.
Like to have someone disappearing is just like, shit. That's scary in itself, but then who's next?
Okay, maybe by this point I'd start thinking, all right, this is probably legit.
We've been turning the camera on you going, Ben, stop joking.
Mainly because I'd be the one screaming in agony at this point.
He'll be the one that's been taken away.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we get to day seven. This is the final act, the last day. A bundle of sticks and some fabric are discovered outside the tent by Heather. She, upon kind of opening it up, she discovers there's bits of Josh's shirt and some teeth, and I think there's some kind of pink unknown item in there as well. She decides not to tell Mike about what she's discovered though. Night falls and Heather records an apology to her family. Now this is the now infamous kind of scene where it's really close
up the nostrils.
Up the nostrils, snot coming out. So she's basically like opening up at this. She's really broken down at this point. And she's basically apologising to her family and to Mike and Josh's family for bringing them out there. And she's basically owning up and saying and taking responsibility for what's occurred. And basically that she believes that they are being stalked and hunted in the woods. And that's her fear, that there's something out there trying to get them. Then they hear Josh's screams again, which leads them to an abandoned derelict house with runic symbols on the walls. Mike runs upstairs to find Josh, but cannot find him anywhere. Heather goes in pursuit. Mike then decides to run down into the basement, and we're all seeing this now. We're kind of into going between Mike's camera and Heather's camera. Heather's trying really hard to keep up. We then see Mike go into the basement. Something attacks him, which we can't see. He drops the camera. Heather then enters the basement. She's screaming at this point, and she then sees Mike's facing a corner of the room. And something then attacks Heather, causing her to also drop her camera. There is silence, and then the footage stops, and then we get closed credits. Of a finale, how impactful was that to you guys when you watched it?
Well, the first time I watched it, actually not very much.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. This would have been so different if I was in a goddamn cinema with a you know, a whole group of people there. Yeah. It wasn't until like the next time I watched it and in with a group of people that it would actually had that impact.
Yeah.
That greater impact. And it's funny because it might not sound describing it to someone. If someone hadn't seen the film and they're listening to this, I don't know why the fuck you would do that. But like, if you just heard... And so a dude stands in a corner and they drop the... That's it. That's the fucking end.
Yeah.
But, like, in that moment, like, by comparison to the rest of the film, it's got that gradual build that you were talking about. This is, like, the equivalent of, like, you know, like, explosions and, you know...
Yeah.
Like, the ending of, like, a Hollywood blockbuster or whatever. Like, it is that what the fuck... When it cuts to the credits, it's that what the fuck moment, you know?
For me, it's one of, and without trying to pick up too much, one of my favourite scenes in movies. It's probably one of my favourite scenes.
Okay.
When they set up a rule in like horror movies where if something happens, this then happens.
Yeah.
And so when you first see him standing in the corner, you're like, oh shit, I remember what they said before. That now means that, and by the time you're thinking this, she's then just, you know, camera's knocked over and gone.
Yeah.
I get tingles just thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is why I wish you were older, Ben, and you'd see this
in my... If you could wipe my memory and I could go back.
Oh, that'd be awesome. So when you see him standing in the corner, for me, it was just terrifying. And you see all the little handprints on the wall, and you know they're lost and there's just two of them. And I think she's got the DAT so she can hear what's going on, but he can't.
Yes.
Which makes it all the more terrifying, because bear in mind, he still doesn't know about the finger in the bundle.
Yes, that's right.
So he's not aware of exactly how you know, fucked everything is now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which just makes it all the more incredible. And then it just finishes like that.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in the cinema, just sitting there for ages going, what?
Well, actually, like, I did think, I'm like, it's like the Sopranos ending. I'm like, that can't be it, right? Just this tape is just like cut out too soon or something.
Yeah.
For me, this that ending... brought me back in, like, because I was, when I first watched it, as I said, I wasn't keen on the characters and stuff, but the way that ending came about, I suddenly was like, that was too brilliant for words, and I loved it. I thought it was an amazing amazing way to end, and like you said, we already told how it was going to end, we just didn't know it, and the way it was told was just great piece of cinema telling.
It's crazy, and then even with the characters, you do get to see a change in them all. Like, Mike then becomes a bit of a hero. He's thrown all that shit away.
Yeah,
he's
gone through that. I do remember thinking that.
Yeah. That, and then she's kind of a bit more grounded, I think. And Josh is dead. Or screaming. Or whatever he's doing.
Well, yeah, that's interesting.
Is he, though?
But even then... Well, yeah, that's it. You never know. And that's one thing I'd love to have maybe have seen a movie about the Blair Witch, you know, her prequel.
Yeah.
More than I would any of the other backstories.
Yeah,
maybe she was just an old lady who saw some kids were sick and gave them leeches and they took
the blood, that's
and
right.
That's, you know, it's all...
Exactly.
Oh, she's a witch, burn her.
Burn the witch!
Was there, like, audible... Like, talk about the cinema that you're in. Like, what was there audible reactions after that moment, or...?
100%. There were people that were gasping.
I'm guessing.
Yeah. There was no one vomiting or shouting or running out, as did happen, though.
Yeah.
Did just it, though, or was it just...
Folklore. Like,
apparently. Again, you know.
Who knows?
Yeah. I suppose
internet says, must be true.
Yeah.
All right. I think we got a kind of general kind of feeling of where we landed up with this movie. Before we kind of dissect that further, a little bit about the makeup. I know Nick's kind of mentioned some of this stuff, and feel free to add some more bits that you've kind of read up on. Mirick and Sanchez were inspired by documentaries of paranormal investigations, and they wanted to recreate something similar with that scary vibe that you got from that natural feel. They basically put a 35-page outline together, which would be written up, and as I said, would heavily rely on improvisational skills of the actors to create the dialogue. During the filming, as you mentioned, the actors were given clues to their next location through messages given in milk crates. All up, there was about 19 hours of footage that was recorded, and that was what got cut down to 90 minutes that we see on screens. Wow. That's a lot of footage to plow through.
Well, 8 days shooting.
The film itself would be one of the first to use the internet in a successful way to promote the release, with fake police reports and newsreel-style interviews. It heavily relied on promoting the filmmakers as missing, presumed dead, and the IMDb website also had the same information listed on the actors. USA Today laid claim that this was the first movie to go viral, in quote marks. The movie grossed around $248 million worldwide. It has captured both positive reviews with critics and public alike, and is often cited as one of the best horror movies in the last 20 years. Witchcraft is obviously heavily is a heavy theme, with influences coming from things like the Salem Witch Trials and the Crucible. And interesting that you noted as well about how the absence of whatever is attacking them happens throughout the movie's entirety. Apparently, an influence on this film was Jaws, which we kind of mentioned before about the whole kind of non-presence.
Doesn't reveal it, even though it does at the end, there is that moment.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
It's satisfying when you see the shark as well. Like, I think there's some horror movies where it can be a bit satisfying. Oh, okay, that's still quite creepy. Yeah. But then when they shed too much light on it, there's a really fine balance.
Yeah.
The same thing with Halloween, you know. You see, like, the face, the mask comes off, like, momentarily. Yeah. But it's not a full reveal.
No, it's shot in a dark light in, and, but I know
this,
what you're saying.
I think in this particular one, I can't imagine if they had decided to show it, like, briefly.
Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps if the camera had, turned back on for a moment, and then there was a face, like...
Like you see in those, like, you know, really quick YouTube clips.
You see it now a lot in a lot of those, The Ring and, like, the Asian horror.
Yeah.
That was then remade into, like, they used that a lot.
Yeah.
Device, as they thought it was creepy. And they put it in the trailers, so surprise is completely gone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But even
if
you had that, like, a slight flicker or something in the background, that, I don't think would still, it wouldn't ruin it. You know, it would add something. You know, as much as I love that final scene, like you say, if the camera had turned over and you had just seen the camera move around slightly and seen some feet or something.
I think it wouldn't have taken away from it, but it doesn't really add anything to it at all, does it?
No.
It's still just as creepy.
I mean, he was originally supposed to be put on a cross. Mike was supposed to be on a cross rather than facing the corner.
There's a image of that, isn't there, online?
I'm seeing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Lame.
Him kind of in, it looks a bit like the stick figure thing that he's been.
Then that would make a bit more sense.
But yeah, like, it's definitely the best ending as well, is having him not looking at the camera. It's kind of like, reminds me a bit of Jurassic Park. I know, bear with me a sec.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's hear this one out.
only the bit with the raptors where you say you're looking at one of the raptors and then out of the corner the other two.
Clever girl.
Yeah. That kind of thing where it's like you're deliberately drawing your attention because you go, why is he looking in the corner before then?
I think we need a mashup of those two scenes.
clever girl.
Do you have any other notes, buddy, before I then talk about some of the companion bits of, of the franchise?
I kind of do, but they'd just be more little factoids. I'm not questioning how interesting they are, but Cannibal Holocaust has sort of been referenced as one of the first kind of found film. I've never seen it. I assume you have.
Yeah.
It's not done in the same way, am I right? It's not like they found the footage. It's more just...
Yeah, it's a bit gory as well.
Well, who would have thought?
Yeah.
But yeah, there are films that influence other films, and, you know... Obviously, this influenced other things, but I'm sure there's reference points for this too.
Yeah.
But it just moves it, just, you know, another step forward a bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's why it's such an integral and important part of horror movie history, is because it, and that's what you look for in horror movies, that you want them to keep questioning and keep pushing the boundaries.
You can't deny that it's influential. Mm. It's a shame that some of the effectiveness is lost from films like Scary Movie.
But we've come so far since those movies. Like, I actually had the poster on my wall when I was at uni. Mm. I liked it that much, and then sort of forgot. I watched it on and off occasionally, and now I haven't seen it in years. Mm. Rewatching it again.
Yeah,
it's the same with Jaws. It sort of sparks off that memory.
You're right.
Nostalgia.
Okay, so there's a couple of things I just want to add to it. So D.A. Stern was the guy that I mentioned who wrote the dossier book. He also wrote a couple of novels following the movie. One was called Blair Witch, The Secret Confessions of Rustin Parr. and Blair Witch Graveyard Shift. There's also been a series of 8 young adult books entitled The Blair Witch Files that were released between 2000 and 2001.
They sound really bad.
Yep. I haven't read them, but anyway, the fact that they didn't kind of flick on the radar of most people, I think, would say a lot about it. Apparently, there was also a 4-issue series comic book called The Blair Witch Chronicles as well. And upon my research, I also discovered there was a trilogy of computer games that were released around the movie. One was called Russ in Parr, one was called Coffin Rock, and one was called Ellie Kedwood, which received mixed reviews. But I'd love to unearth these and potentially do a further review of these down the track, because even if they're shit, I don't care.
Well, they're like, are they like those old King's Quest games? Where
I think they are.
You know,
do you pick up the sticks?
Yeah, well, they're all like Return to Zork. Like, you have died. Go back to the start.
I think it is, to be honest. I think it's similar to that. But I don't know. I'm literally just going on the fact that I stumbled across the fact that these things exist. And I'm like, I need to see these things.
It's got
to
be there on the internet.
Yeah, yeah. So we've kind of skirted around this too, but there was a sequel that came out following year called The Book of Shadows, or Book of Shadows Blair Witch 2. Although now apparently it's not considered part of the canon, and I wonder if this was down to the poor reception that it received. And was it because it was hastily, you know, released after the success of its predecessor? It, as told in this kind of narrative, normal style, and not that of a documentary, as I said. And now I'm going to just try and kind of break down what happens in the movie, so bear
Good
with
luck.
Me.
Good
yeah.
luck.
Okay, so it would center on a group who venture out to unearth the Blair Witch mythology. We have Stephen and his pregnant wife, Tristan, who are doing research for a book. There's Erica, a Wiccan, and Kim, a goth psychic. Joining them is also Jeff, a tour guide and paranormal investigator, who set up camera gear to capture the supernatural events as they happen. They camp for the night at the said ruins, the house where we last saw Blair Witch, the first film. And another tour group arrives, but our group that we're following convinced them that something happened at Coffin Rock, so they should go there, and the group just decides to. When they awake the next day, they have no memory of the previous night. They find documents shredded, cameras are destroyed, and the only thing left are these some of the video files that Jeff shot. Tristan has a miscarriage. They go to the hospital, where Tristan then sees this ghostly apparition of the girl that you mentioned for the first time. Jeff then takes the group back to his place, to an abandoned broom factory. This is the bit that I remember. I just remember this kind of abandoned kind of place that he kind of lives at.
It was a broom factory.
It's probably an old broom factory.
An abandoned factory, but bloody broom. That's got on the nose, isn't it?
I know.
A black cat factory.
Yeah, exactly. When they review the tapes from the previous night, they uncover some strange things. One amongst them was Erica swinging naked, for example.
Yeah.
The group starts to have hallucinations. Then Kim goes out to the local convenience store. She crashes her van on the way back because she sees ghostly children on the road. The next day, they decide to leave. Erica has disappeared, so she's the Wiccan kind of girl. They discover her clothes surrounded by a circle of lit candles. They decide to call up her father, and he tells them that he has no children. Bit odd.
Like, yeah. They call up the church.
Yeah.
And the receptionist says, no, he's never had any children.
Yeah,
it's like,
that's
no,
it.
No, we know she's been disowned. And it's like, no, never had any children. It's like, okay.
So it's still a bit ambiguous at this point as well because of that. They learn from the sheriff that the other group that had, you know, come across them at the camp, who went onto the Coffin Rock, were found at the Coffin Rock, and they were all disemboweled.
Yep.
So kind of living up to the legend of before. Tristan claims that she saw Erica outside, and Stephen goes out to get her, but the walkway collapses underfoot,
yeah.
And he manages to scramble back to safety, and then he sees the ghostly apparition of the young girl again. So that's the bit I kind of, from memory, remembered that one scene,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't say a lot about the rest of the movie. I just kind of just distinctly remember that section.
Barking dogs on that. And
I think so, yeah.
It sounds like
bizarre shit happening.
It sounds like they just threw... like everything at it.
Oh, it gets worse.
Yeah.
So they.
This is like halfway through.
No.
They then discover
Erica's scripted.
Like. Yeah. They then discover Erica's corpse in a closet. So
but she's standing up. And
she's standing up.
Hot. It's weird.
Yeah, yeah. As you do when you're a beautiful
yeah.
corpse. They decide to play Jeff's tapes now in reverse, because when they were watching them, they were all in backwards. So they decide if
yeah.
they watch them in reverse, they'll find out what happened.
Yeah, it's like Twin Peaks.
The revelation is the group have had a drunken orgy from that night that they can't remember. Followed by ritualistic murder of the group that were disemboweled. So it was them that took that acted out their deaths. The group then fall apart, and Tristan ties a rope around her neck, threatening to kill herself. Stephen then pushes her out of anger, and she is killed in the process. There is a jump cut, and we see Jeff, Stephen, and Kim being arrested. They are interrogated separately, and we see CCTV footage of Kim killing the cashier from the convenience store. We also see previous night footage of Jeff killing Erica. And finally, Stephen accusing Tristan of being a witch, and he pushes her to her death. There is no evidence of her hanging herself at all. She's literally just pushed off the balcony. They all protest their innocence, and they close credits.
Yeah, that's... throw in about 50 more jump cuts, and then you'd be roughly...
It is all over the shop, isn't it? So, like, I think we kind of already hinted at where we land in with this one, but you've watched it more recently than I
have. Yeah, I watched it a few days ago, and it was more... It's really hard to work out what you're watching at the start. You're like, is this a parody? Is this supposed to be a documentary? The movie's actually... They reference the movie in the movie, so it's part of its lore. And then it's just a jumble of different people doing different things and trying to tie it all together.
It really does smack for me that it was a rush job. They just kind of went, right, this film's done a success. What can we do with it? How do we up the ante? What do we throw into it? And it probably comes across as a brainstorm room. Yeah. Where you go into a brainstorm room and go, let's do this bit. But the problem is that they didn't have somebody to then kind of tie it all together and make sense of it. It's just left it as it was.
Yeah. You have to diverge and then converge. It's like someone's taking notes, all those bullet points have ended up in the script form.
And it really is.
Stick them all in. And I think it's flawed on so many levels. But when you see the little kids and the girl and the scary things, I love watching bad horror because then you can work out what makes good horror. From that. So you see these seven kids standing in the middle of the road, or this girl in a forest.
Yes.
Should be creepy. And shot, maybe it's the lighting, maybe it's too well lit or something like that. There's some element that they're missing that makes it not scary. For a start, it doesn't seem to fit in the story.
No,
but you remember the seven kids that were taken and the guy came back and said, so that's always what it's in reference to.
Yeah.
But they're dressed in like period costume. They look like a lost cast of Oliver. It's really, really stupid. The one thing to its credit that kind of worked at the end is they I'm going to say witch hunt here. They kind of go on a witch hunt where the woman who's had the miscarriage.
Yes.
She suddenly then says she's the witch and she's going to kill them all and you're all dead. And then the husband sort of, pushes her off. So it's a comic, it's supposed to be an accident, but then she gets hung by doing that.
Yeah.
Then it cuts to the actual CCTV footage and the woman who had the miscarriage is actually terrified.
Yeah.
And scared of her life, saying, why are you guys doing this?
Yes.
And the other guys are like, you're a witch. So it's nice seeing it from the
That's the true, actually. Side.
That's quite a good little
Yeah, I'd forgotten that little moment.
If they'd have had that sort of thought process throughout.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly told from the innocence. So like maybe like with the victims, like even with Erica, having a similar kind of response. So the wicked girl that's found dead, and there's elements in there, I guess. But as I said, it just feels like they've just thrown all their ideas into a pot, and they just didn't actually take the time to work through a decent kind of plot line.
Did you say throw them all into a pot?
Yeah,
just like have all cool. them.
Have I had any puns yet? I don't think I have.
Impressed.
So like,
I'm impressed. I think I've been more sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
But what the interesting part about the second movie is that they actually hired a documentary maker or producer of documentaries to direct it.
Oh right.
Yeah. So I think that's like if they take everything from the original movie. And they get documentary makers to make it. Because the two directors weren't originally documentary.
No, that's right.
So they think, I can emulate this by doing the same sort of thing, but making it more like a horror movie.
Yeah.
Then you've lost already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Doesn't. Why do that? That doesn't make any sense.
Four writers they had. But that's obviously, like, I'm guessing it was just two for the first film. And they were working closer together. But as soon as you double the amount of writers that are on a project, you imagine... I mean, whether that's... They wouldn't have had much time to get that thing out.
No, that's right.
But that horror films tend to be quiet. I mean, look at the Saw films. They release them, like, one a year for how long?
Oh, but the Saw films are a different kind of fish, because that the premise of those is just how do we put somebody in a really bizarre situation that they have to try and get out of. Yeah. It's all about the torture process of...
And it's usually like a room, a single room or a few rooms.
And you kind of you start watching the ones where Donnie Wahlberg's in it, and then you already know that...
Apologies to the Donnie Wahlberg fans out there.
But the plot line... saying that because they're the ones that resonate where I was just like, what the fuck? Because the story doesn't need to make any sense by this point, and that's not why people are paying to watch them. They want to see these people trying to get out of scenarios that they can't actually get out of, and they wait for them to die in gruesome way. That's essentially what they are.
But it's kind of so. It's almost like expectations are always going to be a bad thing. But I think also they just didn't give it the. You're right. They didn't give it the time that it deserved.
Does it say if they had a head writer there, or is it just?
Not immediately obvious when you look something up on IMDb. Whether or not, but you would expect that the original writers were. I don't know how much control they would have had.
I don't know if they did.
Or whether they were overshadowed.
Maybe they
completely.
Well, apparently the directors were forced into doing it, or they were just given executive producer credits.
Okay.
Just to get their name on it, saying, from the people who bought you such and such, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they did it unwillingly.
Okay.
But I know we've got this new film coming out, but, you know, is there possibly, like, did it need to get made? Like, do you think...
This current movie now.
The third one.
Well, I mean, when this was actually made, do you think that... Like, was it as successful box office wise as the first one, or did it make?
No. It was made for like 15 million.
Yeah,
and I don't think it got anywhere near.
Right. So
I think it did. I think from memory, it did fairly well in video rentals.
Yeah.
Because people would go along and go, oh yeah, that.
Yeah,
you know, and they got that. You know,
I'm just curious
watch
to
that,
know
but...
why they would rush it out when you could get a stronger product like. Is it to always? They seem to always.
You lose momentum,
isn't
it? That's
that
the thing.
Halloween date
for
horror movies, especially, seems to be important.
That's kind of foreign, by the way. So I read an article around that about people wanting to bring that. You know, the writer saying we need to bring that back again and have that kind of reason to go and watch something on Halloween. Saw did it for a while. That was like the you know, to bring that movie franchise back into the equation.
Thanksgiving weekend, does it actually equal more money? Like, do they actually get more profits, or is it just?
I don't know. No idea.
Like, if you like horror movies, you're probably not going to watch a horror movie on Halloween. You're going to go and do something for
that's
Halloween.
Right.
You're going to go to a party or dress up.
That's true. Know. Maybe that's why it's not.
Around Halloween, maybe, like in the lead up to it.
Yeah,
you might watch it. Maybe,
yeah. For sure. Alright, so go on.
Oh, no, I'm just thinking of the studio meeting. You know, it must have been so many hands in one pie.
Ah.
Give the kids more of them Blair witches. Like, but I think if the fact that there was no, you didn't see a witch last time, then you were always going to see more stuff this time around.
Yeah, but even then you don't. You still don't, you know, you don't see a witch.
No.
And that's why it's like, it's playing on like the psychological kind of aspect of it, that there's an entity that's playing with their minds and, you know, controls them in a way that...
There seems to be like a lack of, it's like a lack of subtlety.
Yes.
It doesn't, that makes it feel completely separate. From that, for like, you wouldn't have it on a DVD shelf. You wouldn't buy it on DVD to begin with. Like, it's not like it's gonna pair nicely with that first one. In the way that, like, say, Halloween 2 pairs nicely with Halloween 1.
Yeah, for sure.
All
right. So look, with the current movie, as we were talking about then, that's just, you know, come out. Apparently, the true sequel to the franchise. It's called Blair Witch. Went under the title of The Woods for ages. It's directed by Adam Wingard, who's probably like so hot right now, horror property.
He worked on VHS and stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, and like he directed the pilot episode of Outcast when that came out. But he's done, you know, he did Your Next was one of his ones.
Didn't like that.
And The Guest.
Don't know The Guest.
And a bunch of others that I can't think of off the top of my head.
I think Your Next had the premise of being awesome, but I just found it really.
I like Your Next.
Uninteresting. I wanted to. It looked cool. There were geese with masks and stuff. But it just didn't feel...
Although I predicted it, though.
That's probably it.
I kind of knew what was coming ahead of time. But I still enjoyed it.
Miles is
he's the big mumblegore guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I enjoy Adam Wingard's movies, though. There's not a movie I've watched of his that I've come away going, yeah, that stunk. They're watchable and they're fun. And he is kind of raising good questions about horror as well. I think he is one of those directors that's trying to push it in new ground. So my question is, does The Blair Witch Project deserve to be labelled as a modern horror classic?
Oh, yes.
A reason?
Simply put. Just for the emotion it gives you, just for the... with horror, you know when someone... We're probably going to talk about this every bloody episode, but it's always like, if the character makes a stupid decision, you kind of lose me there.
Yeah.
You know, you're an idiot. But in the woods, I don't know what decision you could make, apart from maybe making a joke about it, or... Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You're kind of stuck.
Yeah,
so
yeah, true.
There's really almost no wrong decision. Like, unless you want to kick the map in the creek, okay, that's stupid. But they're at their wits' end, so you almost don't blame them.
No, that's right. There are a lot. So how about you, Blaine? Did you feel like it deserves that label? Or?
Because it set the new benchmark, it actually... You can look at it and see how it affected the industry.
Yeah,
like you have to say that it is. I would say it's a game changer for that.
Yeah,
for the horror
agree.
Genre. In the same way I was talking before, how you know The Matrix was a game changer for action cinema, and films like Fight Club as well. But that's the thing. Like every so often, you get a movie that just completely shakes things up.
Yeah.
And the model as well. Man, it must have been like how well did it work out for studios? Because then they realised you spend this little money.
It's the same conversation we had about Halloween. You know, when Halloween was made, they were like, "You made it for that much, really?"
Yeah.
And then the birth of throughout the 1980s, you got the whole slasher horror movie genre, and a lot of repetition involved.
But it's funny because I don't think it created a subgenre, subgenre. And now that subgenre is kind of a bit of a dirty word, like, for a lot of horror.
I really can't stand found footage horror. I'm like a big kind of, Ant can testify the amount of time. He's a big fan of it, but I can't stand it. There's only a few exceptions. I would now put this down as one of the ones that I do think hits the right kind of mark. The other one I would say is Wreck.
I'd say Rick.
Yeah.
Tunnel. Do you not like Tunnel?
I love the Tunnel. I've got to say that too. My man Enzo was behind it. The Tunnel was an awesome, awesome film.
Man,
and that's a good.
They should definitely check it out.
Definitely. If you're a fan of the Blair Witch Project, you should definitely check out the Tunnel. Very similar kind of style and vein. And that's what I, you know, again, that's very, very simple kind of story. You know, again, going out to. Kind of uncover these. Well, it's essentially like they're going to find the disappearances of these homeless people that have kind of gone down into the underbelly of Sydney. Essentially, they go missing. But yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah, love it. And it's definitely, I'm glad you raised that one into the equation.
And Man Bites Dog, I guess. It could
Man Bites Dog.
Be
I love Man Bites Dog. I so love that movie. Right, and wants to do a kind of a spin-off podcast looking purely at found footage horror. And I mentioned that one to him. I said, you cannot have a found footage horror conversation without Man Bites Dog. Has he seen it? No.
No, he hasn't.
No.
Oh, so
well, I love it. I think it's so good. My next question is, did Book of Shadows tarnish the franchise's reputation in any way?
Not for me.
No.
Like, even going back and watching it now, I'd forgotten how fond I was of that film.
Mm.
Like, initially, you asked me the other day to mention my top 10 movies. It didn't leap to the front.
Yeah.
Unless we start talking about doing the podcast, I'm like, of course, that's got to be in there.
Yeah.
but yeah, when I think horror, that wasn't the first one that came to mind. But it's still, the Book of Shadows doesn't tarnish. It was just no more than Jaws the Revenge does.
Yeah,
it doesn't step on its toes.
Yeah.
And it sits like separately. It doesn't undo. It's like it revisits the first one and makes it less scary.
Yeah.
It could have debugged the whole first film and made it, and looking back at it, may have lost some of its effectiveness, but
that's it.
I don't think it did.
If they showed you the witch in the second one, then maybe.
Yeah.
You know, they'd been like, okay, well, that's what it looks like. So next time when you go and watch the first one again, you're like, oh, it's this big hairy man beast thing chasing in the forest.
It's Bigfoot.
But like, imagine if it had just gone for the exact same like execution, and it was a group going through the woods following the first group's.
Yeah,
I'd have preferred that
in the first film.
But then isn't I think that's
with all the story bits would have been so similar.
I think that's what I mean. Have either of us watched the latest installment yet? Because I haven't.
No, not yet.
It's only just been out from Australian audience point of view. It only just came out the Thursday, just gone from recording this. From what I've seen, I think it goes more down that route of a group of people following.
Mm-hmm. It's
into
it's
the mythology and
her
it's
brother, isn't it?
Yeah, which I wonder about the age gap of that, but you know, because it's 17 years after the fact.
Is he part of the lore that you've read up on? Did she have a brother?
He didn't mention a brother in... yeah. So anyway, look, so I wonder, I am really keen to see it, but I wonder how well that will establish. And when we look at this, what, 3-4 weeks down the track, maybe 4 years down the track, how we will then look back at that movie. But I think that's kind of it. I think that kind of sums up our thoughts and opinions. That concludes our special podcast then, recording of the Blair Witch franchise. Keep an ear out for further podcasts as we continue our John Carpenter early years discussions. Until then, we are Ben Skinner.
Happy witch hunting.
Nick Alford.
Oh, now I've got things, something cool to say. Don't face the corner of the room.
And your humble host, Paul Ferrell. Goodbye.
You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast. The Blair Witch franchise. Music supplied by Peter Nezick. For more discussions or podcasts, head over to surgeonsofhorror.com or head over to our Facebook and Twitter sites for the latest news and updates.